Good evening. Just a small request, could you please turn off your mobiles before we start? Thank you. My name is Jerry Dollarharp. I'm the Executive Director of Partnerships at the University of Melbourne. It is my very great pleasure to welcome you to BMW Edge here at Federation Square. And in doing so, I would like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people, who are the traditional custodians of this land. I would also like to pay respect to the elders of the Kulin Nation, both past and present, and extend that respect to the Indigenous Australians present here this evening. It is a great honour for the University to be involved in this Just One World Forum at the Melbourne Writers Festival, where we'll ask the question, health at whose cost? One Just World is a national forum series, a partnership between the Australian Government's International Development Agency, AusAid, the International Women's Development Agency, World Vision Australia, and a university in each state. For tonight's forum, we are joined by the Melbourne Writers Festival, Melbourne Conversations, as well as the University of Melbourne. One Just World is about providing a platform for ideas and conversations on important development issues and how these might be addressed, to enable you to talk directly with those involved in development, to make your own suggestions and find out more about ways in which you can get involved. Our newspapers and TV screens regularly report on the health of the world's population, preventable illnesses caused by malnutrition, poor hygiene, and lack of access to adequate health care. This accounts for millions of deaths each year in our own region. We may feel concerned and appalled at the shocking images that confront us, but sometimes we think about them as out there, over there, or somehow removed from us and our lives in Australia. Tonight, our speakers will be challenging us as individuals to reflect on our own personal obligations. They'll also challenge us as individual Australians to consider the health of the global poor, especially those in our own region. I expect some very interesting discussion and debate, and some answers on why this is happening and what can be done. I will now hand over to Tracy Hutchison, our moderator for the evening. As a Melbourne-based TV radio broadcaster, journalist and writer, she has been a passionate advocate for social justice issues. Tracy's career has spanned the gamut of broadcasting and media, including the 7:30 Report, ABC Radio, Triple J and Triple R, as well as The Age. Ladies and gentlemen, please make Tracy feel welcome. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Jerry. It is great to see so many Melburnians out tonight on a fairly chilly night to talk about something that I guess we all take very much for granted within a few kilometres of where we sit tonight, some of the city's best hospitals, certainly our ability to take care of our health with such a fantastic public health system is certainly something I think that many of us take for granted. So it's a really opportune moment to take this opportunity to discuss this issue. And we are joined by four very esteemed panellists to talk through the myriad of issues underscoring that question, health at whose cost. Firstly, each speaker will give us a brief five-ish minute perspective. Although I'm not sure I've ever heard Sagar speak for 5 minutes, but we'll see how we go. Then we'll settle into the chairs, have a conversation about some of the issues that are raised, and there will also be an opportunity for you to ask questions of our panellists later on this evening as well, and I certainly welcome and encourage you to do that. Our first speaker is one of Melbourne's most esteemed medical researchers and thinkers. Austrian-born, Australian-raised, Sagus Nossel was the director of the Walter and Eliza Institute of Medical Research for 30 years and was knighted in 1977 for the groundbreaking work in immunology he pioneered there. He was made a Companion of the Order of Australia in 1989, was awarded the Albert Einstein World Science Award of Science in 1990, an award for researchers that, and I quote, brought true benefit and well-being to mankind. He was also the recipient of the Australian of the Year Award in the year 2000. He's a former chair of the Global Foundation Advisory Committee, deputy chair of the Council for Aboriginal Reconciliation from 1998 to 2000. Sir Gus is currently Professor Emeritus within the Department of Pathology at the University of Melbourne. He's also a consultant for the World Health Organization and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and a principal of Foresight Associates Proprietary Limited. He's also found time to be here tonight. He's a proud and much loved Melburnian. Please make welcome Sir Gus Nossal.
Thank you very much indeed, and good evening, my dear fellow panellists. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, it is great to see so many of you here for this important forum. I want to start with a quote from the Irish poet, Nobel laureate Seamus Heaney, who said, "Even if the hopes you started out with are dashed, hope has to be maintained." I've been in international health for 40 years now. I've seen many hopes dashed. But I detect that in the last decade, a new breeze is blowing. New and legitimate hopes are stirring. And in the next decade, we might see real progress. Let's look first at why action is so urgently needed in global health. I think nothing that says it more tellingly than when we look at life expectancy and under five mortality, two general reflections of overall health. Look at the gap between best and worst. Life expectancy in Japan for males is 81, for females 86. In the worst country, Sierra Leone, less than half. Life expectancy for males, 39 years. Life expectancy for females, 43. And as if that isn't a stark enough reflection of a global inequity that is just intolerable, let's look at deaths under five per 1,000 live births, a very widely used measure, surrogate for the health of a community. Sierra Leone, 262. Sweden, 3. Ladies and gentlemen, I don't think I want to live in a world where there's a nearly 100-fold difference in under five mortality between best and worst. But you'll say, look, you're talking at the wrong time. The world's just coming off a global financial crisis. We can't afford to do any more for Africa. We can't afford to put any more into health aid. Ladies and gentlemen, the world can do it if it wants to. In fact, the global financial crisis showed just what governments can do when they want to. The US Wall Street bailout, $700 billion. The stimulus packages from the G20 and really over the whole world, total global stimulus packages, $2 trillion. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan cost one nation, the United States, $150 billion per year. Now, the distinguished health economist Jeffrey Sachs has said that an extra $120 billion per year would make the Millennium Development Goals much more achievable. The world can do it if it wants to. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, health progress is possible. I've mentioned the deaths in children under five, but guess what? They're coming down. Deaths in children under five were 13 million in 1990, 9 million in 2007, estimated 8 million in 2010. And lest you think that that's due to some incredibly sophisticated intervention, most of those 5 million deaths saved are due to simple measures like insecticide-treated bed nets for malaria, measles immunization, vitamin A supplementation, and oral rehydration for diarrhea. Of course, 2/3 of the deaths that still remain were preventable. And my other reason for believing that health progress is possible is that over the last decade, some massive new programs have appeared which seem to have, roughly speaking, the right number of noughts behind their dollar figure. At the head are the two major and very similar programs, the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB and Malaria, instituted in 2002, and the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, the US program known as PEPFAR, initiated in 2004. These are providing imminent relief for AIDS and TB and malaria, but mainly for AIDS, to millions of people now. And would you believe, though, the toll that it exercises is still terrible, there is no doubt that the peak of the AIDS epidemic has passed. Some other programs are getting traction. I've only got time to mention one or two of them. One I think is of fascinating interest is the control of the horrible worm infections, onchocerciasis or river blindness, and lymphatic filariasis or elephantiasis. These are being treated by community mass administration of drugs like ivermectin twice a year, if you want, deworming the community, putting it bluntly. And that is having quite remarkable success. Now, I'm particularly fond of one program where I've been heavily involved myself, which is called the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunisation, or simply GAVI. This was initiated in the year 2000. Through GAVI, 250 million extra children have received the standard childhood vaccines in 72 poorest countries of the world. 233 million children received any or all of hepatitis B, Haemophilus influenza B and yellow fever vaccines, which no one had been receiving before. And the one I think of which I'm the most proud is that measles deaths have been reduced by 74% globally and by 89% in sub-Saharan Africa since year 2000. We estimate that 5.4 million deaths have been prevented in the first decade of this remarkable program. Yet GAVI faces some challenges. 24 million children each year are still not immunized, and there are still 2 million vaccine-preventable deaths each year. And we worry a lot about how we're going to be able to afford to introduce new vaccines that our children are getting, such as the brilliant pneumococcal vaccine, the rotavirus diarrhea vaccine, or Australia's own human papillomavirus vaccine, the anti-cervical cancer vaccine discovered by Ian Fraser. Now to malaria. Well, malaria is a challenge, but the insecticide impregnated bed nets at the cost of approximately $5 each have reduced mortality by at least 50% in those communities that have used them. And although drugs do represent a constraint with the constant threat of resistance developing, drugs can both prevent and cure malaria. And I'm very interested in a program that's a spin-out from the World Health Organization called the Medicines for Malaria Venture, MMV, the Medicines for Malaria Venture. This was a bold attempt to capture the imagination of Big Pharma. And the big pharmaceutical industries have collaborated really wonderfully with MMV. In fact, there are now nearly 50 partners, academic and industry, to MMV. And the companies have made their libraries of prescription drugs available such that 5 million compounds have been screened. And that has brought forward 2 licensed new drugs and 9 other drugs in clinical trial, several with entirely new modes of action. All of that for $55 million a year. Now, you've often heard the statistic that it's cost $1 billion to launch a new drug. Here are here's an exception to the rule, with some cheap drugs coming forward, and much needed, because surely resistance will develop. The Global Malarian Action Plan, which the United Nations embraced on the 25th of December 2008, has as a further linchpin, I've mentioned the insecticide-treated bed nets, where 700 million are going to be needed, has as an extra arm the question of a vaccine. There is no licensed malaria vaccine, but a wonderful 25-year collaboration between the drug company GlaxoSmithKline and the US Department of Defense, the Walter Reed Army Institute of Medicine, has brought forward a vaccine called RTSS. This is now undergoing its phase 3 trials in 16,000 infants in 10 different sites in 7 countries, hoping for definitive answers and registration by late 2011 or early 2012. The phase 2 trials showed the malaria vaccine to be only 50 to 60% effective, but that is a fantastic start to an area that has been very bleak for many years. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I suppose the real world being the real world, the rollout of these ambitious programs will encounter some setbacks. No one thinks it'll be easy. For that reason, I'd like to end with a quote from Nelson Mandela. "The greatest glory in living lies not in never falling, but in rising every time we fall." Thank you.
It's Paul, isn't it? Thank you very much, Sir Gus. Thanks also to Paul, who's signing for us tonight. We continue our stellar lineup tonight with the Minister for Community Development and Women in Papua New Guinea. Dame Carol Kidu is widely respected and regarded as a visionary reformer for her work on women's rights and advancement in the Pacific region. She's facilitated major legislative reforms on rape and sexual assault, as well as legislation on child sexual abuse and sexual exploitation, and considerable work and advocacy around issues of poverty, Indigenous rights, and people with disability. She was awarded the PNG International Woman of Courage Award by the Secretary of State of the United States in 2007 and named Pacific Person of the Year. The following year, she was the recipient of the Regional Rights Resource Team Pacific Human Rights Award, and in 2009, she received the Cross of Knight in the Order of the Légion d'Honneur, the highest award for a non-French citizen. Dame Carol represents Oceania on the FIFA Committee for Fair Play and Social Responsibility, is the Pacific representative on the board of the Commonwealth of Learning, an international advisor on the board of the Cairns Institute, and is a member of the Global Commission on HIV and the Law. She's also a good Queensland girl at heart. Please welcome Dame Carol Kidu.
Thank you sincerely. Hanuboi Namuna. We have already acknowledged the traditional owners and the indigenous owners of this land, and I'd like to acknowledge my mother-in-law, my late mother-in-law, the people of Pari Village, the people of Moresby South, because without them I wouldn't have the privilege of being here today. So I thank them for their support. I'd like to start with a picture in the Highlands area of Papua New Guinea. A Catholic nursing sister, but it could be, she's actually from Germany, but it could be a Papua New Guinean anyone. And she hears this calling from the other ridge. And she hears a man calling. And every now and then during the day, she hears this calling. And then later in the afternoon, all day it had taken, she sees this man struggling up the mountain range with a big billum on his back. The big billum is the one you carry firewood in. And she recognized the sounds of a woman moaning in labor in that billum bag. And this man had carried his wife in the billum bag to try to get help because her birth had not gone normally. She was suffering from an obstructed labour. The sister there, there'd been a lot of tribal fighting in the area. She had trouble trying to find a vehicle. She knew that it was beyond her. She realised the uterus had ruptured and she moved on. She got in a car and got towards the police station to go to Mendi Hospital. The result of the story, after 2 days of struggling for this man to bring his wife to help, was that both the mother and child were lost. And today in Papua New Guinea, between 4 and 5 women will have died in pregnancy or birth-related deaths. About 1,500 women die each year. I'm not a medical professional at all, but I was asked to speak on the issue of maternal mortality. Very important, and maybe child, but I think we haven't got time. I'll stick to maternal mortality. It's a very significant issue in Papua New Guinea at present. We've had a really strong wake-up call. When we got the results of the Demographic Health Survey 2006, and these results came through about 2008, in the 10-year period between 1996 and 2006, the maternal mortality rate in Papua New Guinea had almost doubled, but we are supposed to be tracking towards the Millennium Development Goals. It is true that the 1996 figures were probably under-enumerated, but the fact is our maternal mortality rate had increased. There was no sign of decrease. So it was an absolute wake-up call for Papua New Guinea. We know that we are facing a major challenge in this area. 60% of women in Papua New Guinea give birth with no skilled birth attendant at all. About 35% of women at childbearing age use contraception of some sort. Only 55% of women have 4 or more antenatal visits in pregnancy. And if anything, that's probably a little bit over-enumerated. So there is a very grim picture that we're facing. But we have to respond. The problems are enormous, but there are many positives, and I want to talk a little bit about the positives. Am I speaking too quickly, like I often do? The positives. Because of this wake-up call, and because, although, yes, I know, you get a lot of negative in Australia about PNG, we do have many very decent politicians, very decent bureaucrats, and yes, we have others that perhaps are a little bit questionable, as I'm sure happens in other parts of the world. It's an issue that's been raised on the floor of Parliament many, many times. And as a result of this wake-up call with the Demographic Health Survey, there's been lots of focused action occurring. The government has begun to act by the minister ordering a task force on maternal mortality to get a report done. The report has been completed, and eventually the published report came out in 2009 with 8 major recommendations, basically to get back to basics, and it's deal with systems as we deal with the problems as well. The Maternal Health Command Post has been established at national level just with our response to HIV, which many of you know reached epidemic stage, generalized epidemic in Papua New Guinea, but it appears to be leveling off, but we must never drop our guard. Just as we have the National AIDS Council, we'll be establishing a National Health Command Post on maternal mortality, a very small unit to actually watch it from national level. Government and development partners are working very well together in responses and, of course, with health services in Papua New Guinea. Although we say government, the reality is that about 50% of the services are provided by the Church Health Network, which works with government in partnership to service the people of Papua New Guinea, and it is the preferred health network for most people. And so it's far better government puts money into that network because it is the preferred network. We have some best practices to do with maternal and child mortality. We have the kangaroo mother care concept for our preemie babies. We've got work happening with community conversations, which was introduced for HIV specifically, but it should be looked at to look at all of the underlying driving forces for any major medical or social issue. Because we have to attack the underlying driving forces as well as the issue itself. And that's where health must be everybody's business. I'm not the Minister for Health, I've got no professional health ban, but I must make it my business because I'm the Minister for Community Development. The Education Minister, of course, must make it his business. So our big focus is we must strengthen our systems. They have become very, very poor. You know that we know, and many of you would know, because if you're here, some of you are here. I can see by the billing bags that you have a relationship with Papua New Guinea. Many of our health service networks in the remote areas are now closed. We've got to get them opened again, and we must focus on this. So we've got to strengthen the systems, the healthcare systems, including the workforce and the facilities, and all the other systems that support it. So there are suitable roads and services to get those women to emergency obstetric care when they need it, and so that women can get to antenatal clinics. But if you have to walk 2 days to an antenatal clinic, you're not going to go very often to an antenatal clinic. So obviously we've got to take the services to the people, so we must up and strengthen our human capacity. And our midwifery training has been put as a number one, a very high, high priority in the whole area of strengthening the systems. With this, we must also strengthen the community-based responses. In Papua New Guinea, there's a huge disconnect between Waigani, the capital, and what's happening there, and the community. And we've got to really make sure we can reconnect communities with Waigani in the way we work. The health minister, in publishing this report, and just about 2 months ago, was the task force lockup with the action plan. But he said to a group of us, I'm sitting here with my fingers crossed. I know we don't have the capacity to implement this brilliant work that's a result of a collaboration between church, government, development partners, NGOs to produce this report. And so another initiative is happening, which really was the catalyst for it came from Australia, when the Australia Safe Motherhood Initiative CEO Dimity came up to visit us in PNG, and at the same time, Mary from the Australian Reproductive Health Alliance came up to see us, and so I organised a very quick last-minute forum at Parliament. And so we're now working towards establishment of a PNG Alliance for Safe Motherhood, which will, of course, align with the Australian and with the global movement. And it's so important that everyone sees it as their business and not say it's the health department business. That the partnerships must integrate, not have parallel partnerships, as we try to tackle this massive problem that is facing women in Papua New Guinea. Yourselves here, you're coming here as very concerned citizens, active citizens. What can you do? What can you do to help the women in Papua New Guinea and help stop the deaths of women in Papua New Guinea during childbirth? Talk about it. Talk about your local member. Encourage them to keep up. Encourage for the funding from AusAid to keep coming to PNG in these very targeted areas. Join Safe Motherhood Alliances and get involved by spreading the word that there is an emergency that must be addressed. And the key messages, because I know we're just supposed to introduce now, we must remember that every mother matters. Sometimes in Papua New Guinea, you become very fatalistic about your health. Sometimes you're not very proactive because you just feel it's all beyond you. And people tend to be fatalistic and just accept that women will die in childbirth more than they should. So we must get the message out very clearly that every mother matters, and we must cut down on the number of maternal mortality rate. We must say it is not just women's business. It is everybody's business, and we must have community ownership. That's why in November 22, we will be having a larger Safe Motherhood Alliance Forum during the budget session of Parliament to try to get the parliamentarians to see, well, how can I contribute to this? What can I do in my constituency, in my electorate out there in the back of the mountains where that man came out with his wife on his back in a billum? And we must get back to basics. We've got to get the systems moving again. And that's where we have to do it. And I'll end by a quote from one of the former CEOs of Call to Action. How will the future judge us if we do not respond when we know that we have the tools available to do so? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dame Carol. Our next speaker joins us tonight from Afghanistan, a country we know is in the news for all the wrong reasons, but one I suspect most of us know very little about beyond what we see reported in the news. Dr. Sakina Yacoubi is in Melbourne as a delegate at the UN conference Advanced Global Health. Sakina's two great passions are her country, Afghanistan, and the importance of a good education. With that in mind, she founded the Afghan Institute of Learning in 1995 in an attempt to increase literacy rates and education in her home country. She continued this work through the reign of the Taliban, no mean feat in any circumstance, but particularly when militants targeted schools and individuals who appeared to be influenced by Western culture. Even now, as the Institute's executive director, working as a teacher remains almost as risky as going into the military. 7 million women and children have been assisted with education and health services over this time by working at grassroots level. The Institute was also the first organisation to offer human rights and leadership training to Afghan women and the first to open women's learning centres. Dr. Yacoubi is an internationally recognised social entrepreneur. As such, she's a senior Ashoka Fellow, which is quite an esteemed recognition, and has received multiple awards and honours, including the Jonathan Mann Award for Global Health and Human Rights, the Peter Gruber Foundation's Women's Rights Prize, the Henry R. Kravis Award for Leadership, and 3 honorary doctorates. Please give a very warm Melbourne welcome to Dr. Sakina Yacoubi.
First of all, I am so honored to be here. I really appreciate you inviting me here to share with you what's going on with my country. And specifically, I am honored to be in Melbourne because I find Melbourne a wonderful city with wonderful people, with warm hearted. Thank you. What we are doing to achieve the MDG goals in our organization. As you know, Afghanistan has been through war for 30 years. Going through war for 30 years, the victim was the women and children in Afghanistan. Being the victim is something that is completely destroyed the women of Afghanistan. It destroyed them as a whole, not as a woman. Their complete life has been destroyed through the war. How could you reach for those women to try to teach them about their health, about their body, especially that 80 to 90% of the population are uneducated, they are not able to read and write. So for just that purpose, our organization decided to really target universal education, gender equity, and child maternal health in order to reach for the MDG goal. Why we are targeting universal education? Because the women of Afghanistan need to know what's about their body, because they don't know. They do not have any training in hygiene, in nutrition, in child development, in their own body. As a matter of fact, most of the women in Afghanistan went through the early child marriage. And when you go through early child marriage, you know you by yourself are a child. How could you take care of a child? How could you deliver a child? And especially in a country that the health service is not available. In the rural area, in the villages, people do not have a clinic. They don't have a midwife. They don't have a service that they can go and deliver their baby. Most of the baby is being delivered at home. And that's the reason we try to provide education. Try to train those people, try to train the woman, and also the grandmother, the auntie, the neighbor, how to take care of those women to try to deliver their baby. Because as you know, maternal mortality rate is one of the second highest in Afghanistan. We lose so many baby and so many mother because the mother don't know how to take care of their children. So we try to implement program, try to teach them how to protect themselves, prevent themselves from different diseases. Because right now for Afghanistan, it's too early to just say, we are going to open clinic and we are going to have a hospital, because most of the police is not applicable. We have, yes, hospital and clinic, but you know, human resources, social shortage. We don't have enough doctor. We don't have enough nurses. We don't have enough midwife in order for us to provide those services. So as an individual, everyone is responsible to take care of everyone else's health and to try to help. In order to help, you must give them training to be able to teach them how to protect themselves, what to do in a situation of emergency. In a country that there is no water, the water is not available, we don't have clean water, how do you teach people to take care of themselves when they don't know that in this water is the reason that they get sick? So we must train them how to cure the water, what to do, how to use the water in order to not to get sick. Do you know a lot of diarrhea, cholera in Afghanistan because we don't have a clean water? Yes, there is a clean water maybe in the city, but most of our population live in the village. They are farmers. They are far away from the city. And also the situation in Afghanistan is right now, as most of you know, there is still war in Afghanistan. Safety is not available for those people. When they want to travel to come to the nearby site village like clinic or hospital, their safety is in danger. Most of the family will not allow their wife or their daughter or their children to go out of the house to go to the big city because of security. Security is a big issue in Afghanistan. And that's the reason we decide as an organization to implement program to train people how to protect themselves. And it has been very successful. We have reached many thousands and thousands of women and children, but still we have a long way to go. Gender equity, why we target gender equity? Because in Afghanistan, you know, always half of the population has been considered. The other half, or more than other half, are women. Women have been completely ignored. So if you really want to have a healthy nation, you must target the other half of the population, because those half are the ones who are taking care of the rest of the population. So we must really try to teach them and work with both sex, male and female, and try to teach them because they are have been abused. A lot of women has been abused through violation. You know, many, many things happening in Afghanistan, especially when war is there. Men are frustrated or they don't have a job and they don't have money. The first victim is their children, to beat their children, to beat their wife, to do all kinds of violence against them. So we must try to train those men to be able to work with those women in a human manner. Right now, that's another biggest issue. Maternal child health, what we do, we try to train people side by side as education, also health education. We do have some clinic. We have about 7 clinics all over Afghanistan. But what we do in those clinics, we try to teach them side by side health education, because we believe that reproductive health, hygiene, male nutrition is so important that we have to target those population through those kind of prevention. Because right now the service is not that much available in Afghanistan. We don't have it. We don't have resource, we don't have human resource. So as a result, we must work, try to train them, try to help them to help themselves. And that's we are trying to implement programs such as nutrition program, such as reproductive health, such as hygiene, and to people can protect themselves. So these are the issues that we are trying to achieve the MDG goal. And we have reached like about 7 million women and children in that area. And we run hospital right now, but we really need a lot of resource for it. Thank you. I would love to talk about it more, but I think that I will prefer to answer questions from you people, and thank you for listening. Yes.
Thank you, Sakina. Thank you, Dr. Sakina. I guess it's a timely reminder of our own country's links to yours.
at the moment. Well, as you know, tonight's discussion is held in association with the Melbourne Writers' Festival, in addition to Melbourne Conversations and the University of Melbourne, and our next speaker is very much at home in literary circles. Angela Savage is a community healthcare advocate turned novelist. Her first novel, Behind the Night Bazaar, won the 2004 Victorian Premier's Literary Award for an unpublished manuscript category. And when published, it was shortlisted for the 2007 Ned Kelly Awards as Best First Book. The book is based largely on her experience in Southeast Asia working with the Red Cross to set up in a program on HIV/AIDS during the 1990s, after which Angela established and headed the Australian Red Cross HIV/AIDS Mekong sub-regional program. She spent several years with Sexual Health and Family Planning Australia, working mostly in the South Pacific, and currently heads up a peak body of community development organisations in Melbourne. Angela's second novel, The Half Child, was published recently, and she is a guest of this year's Melbourne Writers Festival and is also with us tonight. Please make Angela Savage very welcome.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen and esteemed colleagues. Good evening. Sitting on that panel listening to the speakers, I was reminded of all of the reasons I loved working in international development and why I miss it so much. And I'm here in my capacity, however, tonight as a writer, and so my presentation is a lot more personal, but I hope you'll see how it's on the same trajectory of the kinds of issues that have been discussed tonight. What I remembered vividly as I was listening to the speakers was a friend of mine in Melbourne during one of my visits back from Southeast Asia. And I think at that stage I'd been spending quite a bit of time in Cambodia in the early 1990s, which was a very troubled place. And she said to me, "I don't know how you can do it. I watch the news and I just want to turn it off. It's all so depressing." And I said, I feel really sorry for you, because I'm there and I'm seeing something that's the opposite of depressing. I'm seeing the hope that Sir Gus mentioned. I'm seeing the work of people like Dr. Sakina and Dame Carol, and I have no excuse to do anything other than hope and to try. As Tracy mentioned, I had a career of about 12 years, which is still off and on, in international development, and was working primarily in the area of HIV and sexual health education at a time when the issue was very new to the Greater Mekong sub-region. I had the privilege of helping the Lao Red Cross to establish its program on AIDS and worked in Vietnam, Cambodia, southern China and Burma during that time. But I'd always wanted to be a writer, and so after 6.5 years in Southeast Asia, I returned to Melbourne with the ambition of fulfilling this long-held dream. I think I just had to have an interesting enough life before I could start writing. And I took some time out of the workforce and went about this attempt to write my first novel, which was a shamelessly autobiographical account of a 20-something Australian woman's experiences in Laos in the early 90s. And I thought, got to the end and thought, no, this isn't going anywhere. Lots of textual detail, no plot. So I turned to crime, as you do. I was writing short stories, and one of them won third prize at the Sisters in Crime Scarlet Stiletto Awards. And that story was set in Bangkok and featured an Australian expatriate detective called Jane. And that was enough encouragement for me to pursue this genre. Interestingly, the more I got into the crime genre, the more it seemed the appropriate vehicle to explore the kinds of issues and ideas that I had, because working cross-culturally is a lot like being a detective. You're always trying to figure out the big picture from a small set of clues. You're trying to work out a reliable source from someone who's just trying to, you know, take you for a ride. And you're searching for meanings lost in translation. And I also believe that contemporary crime is where you see the most vivid critique of contemporary society. Some of us, crime writers, including my colleague Gary Disher, would argue that non-genre literary novels have kind of lost the plot in that area, with few exceptions. So writing gave me the opportunity to reflect on my experiences and also because I've always enjoyed reading the kinds of books that at the end of which I get to and I think, oh, I think I've just learned something. But I didn't feel like it at the time and I didn't feel like I was being hammered over the head. I wanted to write those kinds of novels too, and I wanted to write novels that are based around ideas but that are entertaining reads. And I thought I would read a short extract to give you an idea about how some of the ideas that I grappled with as an aid worker have been translated into my fiction. I hope that it doesn't come across as didactic. I found that one of the best ways to not write autobiography was to give the minor characters in my story the traits that I might have had. So there is an HIV activist in this book, but in fact the main character finds his whole work in HIV a real distraction to their relationship, and that was quite freeing. So in this passage that I'm reading, the main character, whose name is Jane Keeney, is reflecting on an inappropriate relationship that she's found herself in with an Australian Federal Police officer and her friendship with the aforementioned HIV activist, and grappling with some of the issues that their relationship has thrown up. And the novel centres around paedophilia and is set during a time when the Australian government instituted the new extraterritorial legislation to allow the policing of child sex crimes committed overseas. It wasn't only their relationship that made her uneasy. Jane also had doubts about Mark's management of the case. He insisted there was a straight line between the problem and its solution. Paedophilia was a crime, and those who perpetrated it were criminals. Solution? Arrest those responsible and put them on trial. In this, he had both the letter of the law and common sense behind him. What made Jane sceptical was that Mark clung to this belief, despite his experience. Didier would say, such responses failed to take into account the complexity of the problem. They're missing the point, he'd told her. For every paedophile put behind bars, there's at least one other to take his place. For every child rescued from a brothel, the ratio is much higher. In the poorer areas, there'll be 5, maybe 10 others. And those in power will keep turning a blind eye because they benefit the most from maintaining the status quo. It's not about individuals, it's about the whole rotten system. So what's the solution? Didier shrugged. We must find a way to eradicate poverty. Oh, great, she'd snorted. It's good to see you setting realistic goals. But it's true, mon ami, he said with a sad smile. The arrest of one Australian paedophile might keep people in your country happy, make them feel good because their government looks like it's doing something, but it won't change anything. Surely it's better to do something rather than nothing. Didier looked so disappointed she regretted her words. Maybe you're right, he said. Maybe I'm not realistic. But for me, well, it's like wearing glasses. I can take them off. He removed his spectacles and waved them in the air. But I can never look at the world again without knowing what I see is out of focus. Meaning what? Meaning I cannot support doing something when I know it will not work. In that, along with everything else, Didier set his sights on the biggest possible picture. The path he plotted between the problem and its solution was as circuitous as Marx was direct. Caught between the two, Jane saw merit in both, but was satisfied by neither. Thank you. That's cool.
Thank you, Angela, and thank you indeed to all of our panellists for some really salient, inspiring seems to be not quite the right word, but it's been really wonderful listening to all of you, and I guess there's a common theme, despite the differences that are running through all of the work and all of the things that you've talked to us about. I'm going to start with Dr. Sakina and pick up on Angela's theme about, I guess, that that dilemma of thinking that the problem is so insurmountable that it's easier to do nothing, and starting, as you did, on an education reform. from a very unlikely background that started with your father, which I think is also something that a lot of people would find slightly challenging to the stereotype of Afghani men. Do you want to just take us to the heart of what started your own commitment to thinking that education was the key to what the work that you've been doing?
Thank you. Thank you very much for this question. Yes, I think that one thing as a child, when I was growing up in Afghanistan, I just day to day, I saw that many women are being taken to the graveyard because they were delivering baby. And also I was seeing that many children are being taken to the graveyard because they were dying. And my own mother had 15 pregnancy. From 15 pregnancy that she had, 5 of her are alive. The rest of children died. So my mother in front of my own eyes was bleeding to death every time that she delivered baby. So as a child, it traumatized me. Always I wanted to be a doctor to try to help the women of Afghanistan. And when the situation came that I wanted to go to the university, I couldn't because my family were living in Herat and there wasn't a dormitory in Kabul that I could go live there. So I went to the US and completed my education there. But I had a wonderful father because at that time, you can imagine, let's say 30 years ago, 40 years ago, at that time, my father had a vision. He was not educated himself, but he really always encouraged me to complete my education. And so he was the one who sent me personally to United States, although he wasn't a very rich man, and also he wasn't from elite group, and also he wasn't working with the government at all. But he strongly believed in education. So just having a father like that and completed my education, and my country was invaded by Russian. So the first thing I wanted to do, I wanted to give the opportunity, the chance that I had to the women of Afghanistan. And that's really promoted me to really go after the education. And I knew that if the women of Afghanistan are educated, they are able to have a better life. They will have a healthier life. They will be successful and they have sustainable life and they have a opportunity for income. They were very poor and still they are very, very poor. Yes.
It's also the key to breaking cycles of poverty. I mean, we're talking about health being part of that, but...
Well, absolutely. I really strongly believe that, again, education is the key issue to overcome poverty, to overcome health, to overcome freedom. That is, I really strongly believe, because I could see through this 20 years of working with women and children that the progress has been made. It is slow, but I could see definitely that has been made because the women are stronger, they are holding job, they are healthier, they are more economically sound better, they are able to say what they want to say, they are taking the charge of their life because they could say no, because the women's rights are being absorbed because they are getting education. You know, human's rights is a right of every individual. So health is a human's right. Education is a human right. So these are the issues that we are dealing in area of education in order to achieve the human's right, women's right, and MDG goal. I really believe strongly on that.
Dame Carol, I want to get you to respond to, because I think there's some similar themes, but you talked about it's very hard to introduce anything that would resemble any kind of healthcare or health programs if a woman has to walk 2 days to get to a doctor. And you were talking about similar but quite different challenges to being able to address the sorts of issues in your country.
Yes. Well, first I'd say again, education, education, education. It's got to be basic to everything, and particularly education for women and girls. And we've got to look beyond the formal systems. in a country, say like PNG, where we do not have universal primary education, although in elementary level we get to about 80% in, by the time they're in primary school it drops, and by the time we get up to higher levels it drops enormously. So education of women and girls is basic to any of this. And in these areas we've got to go into the community. In a country like Papua New Guinea, where 97% of the land is owned by the people, 3% has been alienated, we don't want our people leaving the land and coming into the urban areas. We have to learn how to get education to people. And, of course, some will leave, but we want them to be able to go back. And so here we need to leapfrog into the future, as in my thinking. Only a few weeks ago, I was sitting on the top of, in a village up in Kokoda, when I walked in with some of the families from here, a couple of families who lost their loved ones in the crash last year, and we went up to the crash site. Here I am sitting up there near the crash site on my BlackBerry, taking in emails, and around me are lots of kids with this typical distended stomachs of kwashiorkor, protein deficiency. Now somehow we've got to combine those two worlds, and we've got to get the modern technology to be able to leapfrog us into the future and take knowledge to people and think beyond the box into flexible outward learning. And this is what I've focused on in my own electorate. Although my electorate is urban, I've focused on the masses that have missed out on the formal system. Because as long as we have increasing masses missing out on the formal systems, other issues kick in, like law and order problems, frustration, and all of those things. So we must reach our people with education. Yeah.
So, Gus, you've been nodding significantly. And I want to ask you, I guess, to respond to, you talked about the Global Alliance for Vaccines, of which you're immensely proud and rightly so. But listening to Dr. Sakina, and in fact also the experience of Dame Carol, both countries with their share of law and order problems, the most extreme, of course, Afghanistan. How do you, I mean, and both women have talked about education being the key. Is that what you see the greatest obstacle to achieving a priority for global health?
Well, you won't get this passionate advocate for health ever to say a word against education. I mean, in my darker moments, I say to myself, well, health and education are both important, but education might even be just a bit more important. So I totally agree with both speakers. I do have a very specific question, however. You might think I'm not trying to squib your question, but you might think there's a bit more too specific. But I am constantly appalled by the fact that we rich countries hire brands from the developing countries that are so desperately needed there. And Dr. Sakina mentioned specifically doctors and nurses. Now, what, if anything, should we be doing to stop England, Canada, Australia, announcing the newspaper, we've just taken 300 nurses from India or Fiji or wherever. Isn't this a very big problem? And aren't we being unutterably selfish when our own training programs could rapidly make up for the shortfall in nurses that we have if only we supported our educational systems enough?
I would like to just say a few things. In Afghanistan, we are trying to provide education, try to train people to be a midwife and a nurse. But although we don't have human resource, but the system is so difficult, because they are demanding that the nurses or the midwife has to go through this long educational processes to be a nurse or to be a midwife. While on the field, we really need somebody that really can go to somebody's house and be able to deliver that baby with little knowledge that we could give that person, and that person can do the job but could save that life. But unfortunately, the system is not allowing that individual to go with that little knowledge that we give it to her to save that life, because the system is so difficult, it's making difficult. But NGO is trying to really provide nurses and midwife to go to people's houses and to save life. But we are really shorting. But although as much as we short and nurse and doctor, but the system is not allowing us to do it.
Angela, I might just bring you in and talk about some of the community-driven reforms that you've worked in, and indeed our speakers are obviously very passionate about as well. But you in Laos and in your work through Southeast Asia had that experience that ultimately, unless you give the community the power over what it is that they're doing, I mean, ultimately your aim as an aid worker is to make yourself redundant, is to actually not be there at all.
That's right. And it's interesting, I see a real nexus of education and health. I've seen that in my work in integrated rural women's development through sexual health and family planning, because education was always the first thing that the villagers asked for when we went in. Education, education, education. So, but of course the children can't go to school if they're sick. And they're often sick because of preventable diseases or poor water and sanitation. So one thing leads to another and projects start to become much more responsive to need. And we need projects and we need funding to be able to be flexible, to respond to those needs as they emerge. But the example that always stands out for me about why we need to listen to communities and why as aid workers we need to go in with a sense of humility and a sense of needing to learn. And this is a very grassrootsy kind of example, but in the villages we were working, one of the objectives was to get people to pen their animals, pen their pigs and their chickens and things that otherwise ran around the village and, you know, made the village pretty messy. And it was a public health and hygiene strategy, and it was supported by government policy. And we would go into villages to monitor progress of the project, and we'd walk in the village and the animals would be running around, and we'd talk to our project teams, you know, what do we need to do to make a difference? And that's, we have to keep telling the villagers to pen their animals. We have to keep telling them it's government policy. And then we introduced a participatory evaluation that was really about, you know, asking good questions, getting people to be comfortable telling us what was really going on. And what emerged was that there were two different issues going on in the villages. One, the villagers said, well, we don't have latrines, we don't have toilets. So the foraging animals actually keep the village and the surrounding area clean of human excrement. Okay, very logical use of animals. But it also gave us then the leverage to go in and say, okay, latrine building, that becomes another part of this project initiative. In the other case, the villagers were actually, the village that they lived was a village they'd been forcibly relocated to. They were an ethnic minority people who traditionally practice Swidden agriculture, which is slash and burn. And their real village, their heartland, was up in the hills, a three-day walk from the village they ostensibly had been allocated by government. So they weren't penning their animals, because if they left their animals in pens for the amount of time it took them to march up the mountain, do their farming and come back again, the animals would have died of hunger. And that was a harder issue to address because it cut against government policy. But it spoke to at least starting to hear the voice. And we were working with low-order government officials, but for them to be in a position where they heard the voice of the villagers and started to perhaps question the authority of a central policy, just starting to chip away at that. And so there were a couple of very practical examples about why we need to, as I say, go in very humbly into these environments and see our role very much as resourcing local people to respond to the challenges and take control of their health and life, rather than seeing ourselves as any kind of experts.
And also the complexity of the issue and I guess the number of levels that you need to be working on at any given time. You know, you've all said education is the magic wand, is the silver bullet. You know, if education is the answer, you know, why is it so hard to achieve the sorts of things you're aspiring to? Either of you, anyone.
Well, I think that, again, for me specifically, I have been doing this for 20 years now, and education is, I think that is the solution for it. It is not to get, it's not hard to do it, but there is a system that is stopping us, for example, to get that education. For example, I will just tell you, we start a literacy program. Somebody who doesn't know how to read and write. And we design a fast track classes. That means that from in 1 year, they can go in 3 grade level higher. In 2 years, they finish sixth grade. And by sixth grade, they are able to read and write. And by sixth grade, they will be able to take hygiene program, take a prevention method to how to cure the water, how to cure the environment to be cleaner, and how to do the hand wash, and to be able to take some hygiene procedure to be able to save life. So for us, for me as an individual, I think that is wonderful. We should do that, and we will do it. And we send that individual to a village and will be able to. But as a system, is not allowing that. The system says, well, this person has to finish 12th grade, then has to go through nursing program to be able to do it. So this is something that we are going around and we do it because we see that people are being dying every day. We have no choice. So education is the issue and it's easy to do it. And we are doing it. But if you really want to go to the formal way, we have a problem. Yes, we need doctor, but we don't have doctor because we cannot produce doctor. Doctor has to go through higher education. And to go through higher education, then they have to go to those steps. And in order to go to this step, we need money, we need funding, we need resource, we need, again, a system and leadership, and we don't have it.
Dame Carol?
My background is actually education. I'm an educationist by profession, a secondary teacher, and a curriculum writer. And when I had the privilege of being thought about for a ministry, many people thought I would want the education ministry, but I'd taught in that, and I knew that it alone was not the solution, as far as I'm concerned, in Papua New Guinea. So many people were not even getting into it, access, for various reasons, and so many people were being pushed out by a system of exclusion through examinations, etc. And so that's why I took on what was called the Too Hard Basket, the Ministry for Social Welfare and Development, renamed it the Ministry for Community Development, and I had a wonderful, wonderful secretary and senior management staff. I asked them to completely rethink the whole thing, and we're working on education through flexible learning models. And the linchpin at community level is fostering and enhancing and facilitating, strengthening the community learning centres that are already happening out there. People don't lie down and die and give up. They respond to their problems. They are extremely resilient, and they're also already, we've got a directory of thousands of learning centres around the country, women's centres, whatever. So we've been working, and we're still working. It's a long way. We've had rollouts so far in 13 districts, and we've got 89 districts altogether. But 13 districts means 13 of 20 provinces on trying to establish district focal points for community learning in partnership with education, in partnership with health, to bring flexible learning models to people. The big challenge now is policy issues of how can people move from that flexible learning into this system that says you've got to sit in a classroom for 8 years before you can go up the next step in the ladder. You know, crazy stuff. How can we have a community learning certificate? And that's the next policy thing to work on, so that people can move through, you know. So it's critical, and looking at appropriate learning for the needs of the communities. Yeah.
So Gus, would you see that as one of the greater obstacles that you've observed in trying to implement the global work that you do?
I've thought that our two distinguished women speakers have skirted around what is to me the central problem. To me, the central problem is that male-dominated societies are not as passionately committed to the education of women and girls as everybody in this room is. I think it's a big problem.
Maybe you might add that decision-making in most nations is dominated by males. I am 0.9% of the Parliament of Papua New Guinea. So maybe we have to change the decision-making balance also. in our nations.
Well, we're grateful, Sir Gus, that you've become the token bloke for the evening, so yes. Thank you very much for that. Angela, you're sort of nodding too, as this has been an experience of yours as well, and I guess there's a lot of people nodding in agreement in the room.
I think one of the challenges, to go back to that greater question that Sir Gus posed before about, you know, what do we do about these inequities, the poaching of talent from developing countries, and I was tempted to paraphrase my character and say we must eradicate poverty. But I don't want to be trite about that. I think that is a huge challenge. And I also concur with Sir Gus that in the last 10 years, we have seen real progress. I've seen the HIV epidemic in Southeast Asia turn around from a time when it looked like, just appalling and terrifying, to being something that's almost being managed as a chronic illness. So I think there's real signs of hope. But we as a community in Australia really need to keep up the pressure on our government to continue to increase the percentage of GMP that is committed to international aid. It's not very much at the moment. It should be more. And I think we also have a real empathy deficit in this country. And we see that most vividly in policies around asylum seekers. But also, I think there's a continuum that connects that to international aid. And I guess I see, in a small way, my role as a writer is to try to humanise the big picture stories and the statistics, to try and give people an insight into the kind of humanity that we're talking about, and to try and bridge the gap to see that we actually have more in common than what sets us apart. So I think part of our challenge is to build, and that's why it's so inspiring to see a room full of people like this tonight, is to build the groundswell to see political leadership and strength and support, so that you see real investment at the level that it's needed in countries that are disproportionately far less wealthy than Australia, not forgetting that the reason why there are developed countries and developing countries has its origins in colonialism, and it's got nothing to do with the human resource in those countries or even the natural resources in a lot of those countries. And I think we have a historical debt to repay in that respect.
I'd like to make a comment too on the brain drain factor, which has become very significant in the Pacific region as well. I believe almost half of our doctors, qualified doctors, are now serving overseas, not in PNG. And you can't really blame them, because they're wanting the best possible opportunities for their family. But there's also the brain drain factor internally, as well as cross nations, where now with the major PNG LNG project, this massive corporate sector investment coming on. I spoke to an administrator down in Milne Bay, a long way from the PNG LNG project. I said, I guess it's not affecting you too much down here. And he said, hey, don't kid yourself. I've already lost 5 of my top bureaucrats. We have teachers leaving the classroom to go and be security workers with the PNG LNG. We have often our some of our best staff end up in the development industry, working in AusAid and places. And we can't stop this, but it is a significant issue that we have to be aware of. And so an already perhaps weakened system becomes more weakened. And we talk about failed, fragile states. Well, maybe we're all contributing to the weakening of those systems by this brain drain away from the government systems. Yeah.
We do have a short amount of time left this evening if people do want to ask questions of our panel. There are some roving mics, as I understand, and I'm staring into a lights and shiny things, and I'm not sure where the microphones are. But whilst we find one of those people with a question, I might just ask Dr. Sakina just one last question before we go to the floor. And I guess it's a delicate issue in this country at the moment, with our own country's involvement in your country on a military level. But I guess the kinds of things that you're talking about, how would you see the need for, I guess, the stability, the political stability in your country to contribute to the aspirations that you've got for the education of the, particularly the women that you're involved with, and how do you see, I guess, the military backdrop around that kind of playing into it?
Thank you. I really strongly believe that the people of Afghanistan deserve that the NATO ally stay for a while in Afghanistan, and to really, in order for the people of Afghanistan to have the opportunity to rise up. Because for the 9 years that our country is struggling, still we didn't get the training and the service that we needed. This last year is they are starting to give us some training, because I think the people of Afghanistan could not manage it without training and without job skill, because right now poverty is all over Afghanistan. Women of Afghanistan is trying. There is a lot of good things is happening in Afghanistan, but the security is not allowing people to go from state to state. So we really are in trouble if we want to go from different province to different province. We are not able to because of security issue. But if the security is allowed, we could reach out thousands and thousands more. And that is one thing that I really believe strongly, that the people of Afghanistan deserve to be listened to, and to civil society really are the victim right now in Afghanistan, especially women and children.
Okay, I think we do have a couple of questions from the floor. We've got about 10 minutes left, and we do have to finish pretty promptly on time. So if whoever's got a microphone could stand up. Great, thank you. And
my question is for the panel. What would the panel's comments be for the notion that improved healthcare in developing countries such as in Africa would simply augment the population growth and the sustainability of it?
I think I can take that one, because fortunately, to your important and frequently asked question, there is a very simple and 100% dead set sure answer. The way to control population is not through increased death rates. The way to control population is through decreased birth rates. And time after time, example after example of countries in transition has shown that as you can lower infant mortality rates and mortality rates generally, so communities who are not stupid voluntarily reduce the number of children that they have. One of the reasons why people in developing countries that are really poor have so many children is that they want to make sure there is at least one son, I'm sorry to say it has to usually be a son, to survive, so to look after them in their old age, because there's no other social security system. But, you know, demographers are absolutely united on this point, that the raising of death rates is not the way to control population growth.
Thank you, Sigas. Yes, we have another question.
Is it on?
Yes, Steady's on.
Thank you, and thank you for your informative discussion. It's very, very helpful and useful to hear all you've got to say. I'd be interested to know what you think of the model that Cuba has been presenting the world of in the last 5 or 6 years, and the example of East Timor, where they have sent 400, I believe, doctors to far and remote places to practice medicine in places where people have never had medical practitioners before. But more importantly, they've taken 800 people, young people, across to Cuba to train them in the medical profession. And to me, it's a very, very strong message of where there's a will, there's a way. And this whole paradigm that we're involved in with international aid seems to be very piecemeal by comparison. That's my opinion. I'd just be very interested to hear what members of the panel think about that model, and whether there's any hope that the Western countries might be able to produce something of equal standards.
I'll have a go at this and I'll shut up for dead set sure afterwards, because I have just come back, literally just 48 hours ago, from Rio de Janeiro, where I spent much of the time sitting next to Sir George Alain, who's from Barbados and who ran the Pan American Health Organization for a good many years. The occasion, by the way, was a celebratory symposium for the 30th anniversary of the eradication of smallpox, and its purpose was to ask, what 30 years later have we learnt, and how can we use the smallpox eradication to do better with other diseases? And I asked Alain, what did he think of Cuba? And he said, well, of course, it's clearly the best health system in the world. Why is it the best health system in the world? It's the best health system in the world because the dictator makes community health, and for that matter, community education, a top priority. As simple as that. Cuba has one of the highest immunization rates in the world. It has remarkable mortality statistics for a very poor country. And therefore, I'm 100% agreeing with you. If there is a political will, there is a way. It doesn't need immense riches.
Thank you. Thank you, Sagath. Thank you for that great question.
Can I just add very briefly to that? I think that we, and this is kind of a call out to the funders again and to the NGOs in the room, that we need to get better at evidence-based programming. I think the piecemeal point is very true, and we need to be looking to examples like Cuba as a model that can be applied elsewhere and that have been subject to rigorous evaluation, like Sir Gus has mentioned, where you can actually see the impact in terms of indicators, not just the number of people trained, but the impact that it's had on health and on mortality and morbidity statistics.
We have got time for one last question, I've been informed, and it's you. Yes, hello.
Do you know about the existence of RAWA, Revolutionary Association of Women of Afghanistan? And could you speak about it, please, a little bit?
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes, I do know the organization. I know about them. They are very active. I am not involved with their program, but I know of them, and they are working in different level than I do. Yes, thank you. That's all I can say.
Okay, I've been instructed by the sir on the panel that we should take another couple of questions, so I'm... Let's follow the token bloke's advice and take a couple more questions from the floor. Yes, that gentleman up the back, thank you.
Hello. My question for the panel would be, what connection do you see, or what connection can you establish between issues of food insecurity and the disproportionate divisions of food, you know, within the developing countries and, provision of healthcare?
Who would like to take the question?
Carol.
Carol.
I didn't hear it properly.
food security and distribution of food in developing countries and its impact on health.
Yeah, I don't think, I'm not a health person, and I don't think I should be taking that. Well, I think Sir Gus should be taking
I promised I'd shut up.
Yes.
Got to give everybody a fair go.
I actually didn't catch the crunch of it.
Well, my question was that what connection do you see between disproportionate division of food in third world countries, what we call food insecurity, and provision of healthcare? What connection do you see between nutrition and healthcare? Yeah.
That might be a question. Oh, okay.
I'll say something. I think with Papua New Guinea, you can see it in the sense of not the food security in sense of food availability, but in the nutritional levels of the food availability. There is a definite relationship. And I don't want to say much more about it because like I talked before about the protein deficiencies in some of the areas. Yeah.
Sakina?
Yeah. Yes. For example, in Afghanistan right now, people are living in poverty. And when people live in poverty, they don't have enough. How about nutrition-wise, they don't get anything. Mm-hmm. So, and according to that, people are sick because they don't have enough. And when people don't have enough, they are sick. So we have to look into poverty to take get rid of poverty to people be healthy. And that's, we are trying to provide a skill training that they have a job, that they be able to support themselves, and then they will be healthy. That's it.
And the huge increase in, say, the urban areas that are emerging of, again, the people in poverty have a diet of rice, usually with very little protein or anything, and tea with a bit of sugar, and then the non-communicable diseases where sugar is taken in excess, all of those things are coming in too. And so there is a whole issue there too, a new dimension that we're having to deal with.
I think food security is one of the pillars of primary health care. And the United Nations itself has recognised that a back-to-basics approach is really called for at this moment. And all of the initiatives that we've been talking about on the panel tonight fit in the primary healthcare rubric. Family planning is there, vaccination is there, improved access to safe delivery for women is there, education is there, water and sanitation. And these are fundamental building blocks. So there's a situation in Cambodia I'm aware of where villagers have access to state-of-the-art antiretroviral drugs for their HIV, but no, they don't have enough food to make those drugs effective.
Yeah.
So we really need to go back to the basics of primary health care in programming to provide the kind of foundation for a whole lot of other initiatives.
Yeah. I'll take one question here too. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This is for all of you of the panel. From your position as distinguished and international leaders in education, health and community development, is there something you're doing to create a call for action in Pakistan right now?
I can answer. Yes. For example, right now we have program in Pakistan, and we are not humanitarian organization, but because the situation is so bad right now and people are suffering so much, especially right now there is 1.5 million Afghan refugees in Pakistan and they are suffering through this flood. And we are trying to provide assistance for them, such as cooler for water and bucket of cooked food, delivering to them to try to give them assistance. That's the action that our organization take place as soon as we find out that the Afghan refugees, especially, that nobody was reaching for them. Of course, the Pakistani community are all of them are in trouble, but millions of dollars, if it's going, it's at least get to the some people, but not to the Afghan refugee. So that is the action we took place right now. We are serving the people of Pakistan. Yes.
Thank you. Did anyone else want to take that question?
Well, it's sort of like, where do you start and where do you stop on that question? I think the main thing is do something. Yeah. Don't do nothing. Gandhi said, be part of the change that you want to see. And I think if you look at these esteemed speakers here and the circumstances that they've talked about working in, we have no excuse not to do something. That's all I would say. There's plenty of options out there. But do something.
And that might be a good place to leave the conversation. Could I just thank you all for being part of what's been the 26th forum in the National One Just World Series, which looks at key development issues affecting members of the global community. This one, of course, held in conjunction with the Melbourne Writers Festival, Melbourne Conversations and the University of Melbourne. Tonight's forum, you might have noticed that there are cameras in the room. Tonight's forum will be screened on ABC's Big Ideas program, so you can look for your program guides to see that. You can also see it on the One Just World website, the Melbourne Uni website and Slow TV websites in the next couple of days. The One Just World website, if you've not been to it, it's worth a squeeze, www.onejustworld.com.au. You can register via their website for updates, all sorts of information about upcoming things. You can also add your comments and suggest ideas about other things that you might like to see the organisation be involved with. And just feel like you're part of a community that, as Angela's beautifully articulated to finish this conversation tonight, that, you know, if you want to live in a better world, then you've got your own responsibility to take some charge of that and be part of it to build a more just and equitable future. So thank you to the partners in this forum, the International Women's Development Agency, AusAid, World Vision Australia, the Melbourne Writers Festival, Melbourne Conversations, and again, Melbourne University. And also please thank our wonderful speakers tonight, Sir Gus Nossal, Dr. Sakina Yakubi, Dame Carol Kidyu, and Angela Savage. I'm Tracy Hutchison. Thank you so much for coming out on a wonderful night, and I'm sure our guests will only be too happy to continue the conversation with you. Thank you very much, and thank you to Paul as well for signing through the night. Thanks so much. Good night.